Welcome to Improv Interviews with Margot Escott, a psychotherapist in Naples, Florida, who is using her 35 years of experience to develop improvisation programs, benefiting and improving the lives of those with emotional and physical challenges. Improv Interviews brings together the world's leading improvisational theater masters, founders, and innovators who are using improvisation therapeutically in unique and surprising ways. With great guests that include legends like Ed Asner and Aretha Sills, you're sure to learn something new about improvisation. This is Improv Interviews with your host, Margot Escott.
Today I have a wonderful gentleman all the way from Copenhagen, Denmark, Troels. Good morning or good afternoon. I'm so pleased that you can be here today.
Very happy to be here. You know, it's a very convenient 4 p.m. for me, so it's very good times.
That's wonderful. And I think we've met once before, but tell me a little bit about your improv journey, how you got into it. I know you're a big D&D fan. And of course, I'm a big Hans Christian Andersen fan. It's a little different, but that's my favorite writer from Copenhagen, of course. And so tell me a little bit about your improv journey and about yourself. You said you had two parents who were pastors, so let's talk about you.
Yeah, sure. Both my parents, so my mother is still working as a pastor, and my father was a pastor. And I went to a type of school, a type of private school until I was 13, that had, it was created by a Danish theologian called Grundtvig, and he was, he was of course a theologian, but he was this big figure in Danish society. He focused a lot on folklore, translating old sagas and all that stuff. And this, he created this, along with a guy called Kristen Kott, they created this new school tradition. And this tradition still to this day is very much focused on, until age of 13, when the school stopped at that grade, there were no grades, they didn't believe in grades. And also, lots of focus on storytelling. Basically every, the first few years we would have Nordic mythology, Greek mythology. It was part of sort of the program, the curriculum. So I grew up second grade, and that would be third grade for people from America. Third grade, we would have Norse mythology. Fourth grade, we would have Greek mythology. So you grew up with this sort of storytelling tradition, which I think very much stimulated my desire to experience stories. And then I did a bit of theater when I was a kid, and kind of, but it's a classical thing where you're conditioned to think that you shouldn't pursue theater because it's not sustainable. It's the classical story. You need to have something to fall back on, something stable to fall back on. And I chose anthropology, which is not something stable to fall back on. And I even doubled down. I took 2 degrees. I have a bachelor's and master's in anthropology, social anthropology. And that is, if you want to have an interesting time studying, anthropology is great. If you want to have job security, maybe not. Yeah. So at some point I was working, it was a contract, I was working, it doesn't, not very important where I worked, but I had a manager, and she said, just sort of an off-the-cuff remark, that she and a friend were going to see an improv show in Copenhagen. This was in 2017, and I don't think they ever went. I think they had to make other arrangements. But then it was raised, in my awareness that there was English improv in Copenhagen. And like you said, I've been doing Dungeons and Dragons for many years. I've been doing it since I was 15. So that, I think that was sort of my gateway, a drug in a sense, because it's very much about making up stories and whatnot. And
right.
I needed also something more social in my life as well. So I signed up for a drop-in workshop in April, I think April 14, 2017, and then I started. I start, and then I did another drop-in, and then I started doing these intensive. If it was, I think it was very much. So ICC, which is the theater where I trained, is very much based on the IO Chicago tradition, because Stephen, who founded ICC, he had done he was a, he's been an actor his whole life, and he started doing the intensives in IO a few summers before, and so he started doing an improv festival, and then they opened a theater, and this is very much in the IO tradition, and then this he incorporated this idea of intensives. So I did a level 1, 2, and 3 as intensives, and then immediately after, because at that point I was just all in. There was Jay Suko, who was doing workshops that were of a level that I absolutely was not prepared for, but at the level I was at, but got but allowed me to immediately do workshop, work, participate in a workshop with people who were way more experienced than I was, and I think that's always one of the things that you learn the most from is when you're getting to be around people who are very good at what they do, and yeah, and then I continued did levels 4 and 5, and yeah, and then that's how I got into improv, basically.
And you were performing with ICC or?
No, I used to perform with ICC for a while. I haven't actually performed in a little over a year, and we'll get back to that when we talk about mental health. But I was performing with ICC. I was part of a delightful little long form team called Standard Deviation, which was tragically short lived. And
Oh,
then
standard deviation.
I.
Was that standard deviation you said?
Yes, it was named by someone who loved statistics, and then I was part of for a while the short form ICC team, and then for a while I performed with the wonderful team called Supercut. Formerly known as Spoonraker. It started out as a James Bond spoof, improvised James Bond spoof. I'm not part of that group anymore. They're called Supercut. They're a fabulous group. I think you spoke to one of the other members, Sarah McGillan, one
Yes,
of my favorite improvisers, Sarah McGillan.
She's lovely.
Oh, yeah. And, absolutely, a powerhouse of an improviser, and then we did a bunch of other genres. I believe right now they're doing. We also did an improvised horror. I believe right now they're doing improvised fantasy, and they're sort of branching out. But yeah, I've been out of improv for a little over a year. I also did solo improv for a little while, solo narrative improv. I did
Wow.
a few shows of that.
It's beautiful. And I know you're, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I actually, my sentence was finished.
I know you're a vocalist, a singer, and you write songs. And did you do some musical improv back then?
A little bit. I sort of dabbled in musical improv. A few years ago at the improv festival, I did workshops with Stacey Smith,
Oh,
who
yes.
is a very absolutely. Wonderful, very, very skilled musical improviser who originally from the US, and I believe still based in Amsterdam. I'm not quite clear, but she's been based in Amsterdam for a while and running what's called Boom Chicago in Amsterdam, which is a wonderful
I love Stacey. She's beautiful
improv.
and energetic. I just love her so much. She's wonderful. I've taken classes with her and seen her in shows when she was in the States. So terrific. Well, let's talk about
Oh,
when
absolutely.
you. Sorry?
Not enough.
Let's get to what's
Forgive
been
me because we have a
happening.
little bit of a delay, so.
Yes, I'm going to try to be more mindful of that if I can, okay? So let's talk about what's been going on with you for the past year or so. And I use the phrase creativity and madness, madness in a not a negative way necessarily. And as a therapist, I've worked with a lot of people with various, mood disorders, and I myself have anxiety as well as some other things. And you started, I think, let's hear your story because you suffered depression. Was that starting as a child that you were suffering depression?
Yeah, I would say, like, as a child, I started having exhibiting depression. I've been told by my mother that basically since I was an infant, I would be very sensitive to noise, to everything as a so basically I've always been very sensitive to like stimuli, and as a child I started exhibiting symptoms of anxiety and depression. I think it wasn't until I was like 15 that I put it into words, but I've had some level of chronic depression, not quite as long as I can remember, but at least for I'm 36, so at least for over like 20 years for sure, longer than that. Yeah.
And when you got into improv, did that help alleviate some of your depression and quell anxiety at all?
I think so. It also, a few years later, I was diagnosed with ADHD, and I think I know quite a few people in improv who have ADHD. I think I also know quite a few people in improv who have autism. I think it is. The sort of the umbrella term is, I feel like it's a safe space for nerds. Believe a lot of people on the neurodiverse spectrum are nerds because we tend to fixate on specific areas of interest and very sort of imaginative, easily bored sometimes. And improv is a place where I believe the traits of what we call ADHD is that all these traits, they are very much an advantage because you can think fast on your feet and come up with ideas off the cuff. And so that was an interesting thing where I felt I could use my imagination and socialize with other people in a way that was other curious souls, basically.
Yeah, there's a little book, the story of the Misfits Island, and I think that Misfit is a good name for us improvisers and comedians because we don't necessarily quite fit in. It took me many years to discover improv, but I always felt I didn't quite fit in. I mean, I could be in social situations and all of that. But I never, until I discovered improv and improvisers, I felt like I was from the island of misfit toys.
That and I think that's something that is such a it's a nice I like what you said when you said misfit toys. Now I'm almost like thinking of like sort of a Toy Story situation, all the toys that are a little outside, the toys that are not, the charismatic leaders like Woody and Buzz Lightyear, the people that the toys that are sort of in the fringes of
Yes.
the living room. Yes, it's funny because I did D&D for so many years, and even though I've done it for so many years, I didn't feel quite as home in that society at large. I didn't feel as comfortable. I do feel, but not as comfortable as I did when I found improv. Like improv was, I think it's partly because sometimes things like role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons, they can be so defined by rules, which of course there are rules in improv to some extent, well, frameworks. But I think sometimes games like D&D can get caught up in arguing about rules and so on. And the whole idea of improv was there are frameworks and techniques, but it's about having fun, especially when you start out. You're having fun, you say yes to ideas, you're not getting caught up in the minutia. And I think that was very liberating.
I totally agree. And from my first class, you know, as somebody with various disorders, and we're going to talk about some of those labels we get in a moment, but I became instantly obsessed and attracted. And it's basically all I do today. I've retired from my career and I have a new career. And it's that acceptance and that feeling of part of, and not, you know, we're not going to love everybody that we're partnered with necessarily, but we keep it in, the focus is on relationship to a great deal and playing with relationships and developing relationships in a safe environment. Now, let's get on to what's been happening with you recently, because I think it was very brave of you and very courageous. After you've had several years, I guess, of therapies and medications, that you entered a psych unit by your own, on your own. You were a what we call a voluntary patient. So let's talk about how you made that decision and what your experience was like.
So I'm going to sort of, like I said, I've had these recurring periods of depression, and then I think recurring periods of something I didn't have the language to describe, which is that when I was coming out of a depression, I would switch and suddenly be very, very proactive. I would start lots of things. I would have a lot of energy. And ignore warning signs that I was reaching burnout. And that's happened before. And then I think in the past year and a half, it was sort of a gradual process of me overextending, not knowing my limitations. I think being a pain in the ass to people around me to some extent. And then having like these very abrupt times when I saw the consequences of my behavior in a way that I think I've certainly alienated some people, because I was in a state of mind where I was like very single-minded in some things, and I was getting irritable, I was getting louder, I was leaving more space for other people, and that's, we'll get into that when we talk about what medically is called hypomania. But basically I was burning too much fuel that I didn't have, and it sort of, then I had in fall last year, someone I know died from, some same age as me, died from cancer, which was very surreal. And they were only like, from diagnosis to death, it was like 3 months. And that was very much reminiscent of my father, who from diagnosis to death was 2 months, like 6 years ago. So,
oh my gosh,
that kind of, and though I think there was sort of like just the thing, like it was one thing of many that had been building up, and then I kind of just collapsed. And a couple of months, I was gradually isolating myself. I was not talking to anyone. I was ignoring everyone, even close family. And then it culminated in two instances where a very good friend of mine sort of just called the police in terms of them coming to and making sure that I was alive, you know, that I hadn't committed suicide or something. And so they came to my door, and that was one time, but then I kind of fell back into isolation. And then it happened again he called the police to me, and they came to my door and made sure I was alive. They were very sweet, by the way. They were extremely sweet to young officers who were very, very sweet. They just wanted to make sure I was safe. And that the second time was when I'd already been thinking about it. I have a very close family member who was in a psych ward in the past, and I think that gave me a better idea of what a psych ward is, because I think I'd had some, like a lot of people have misconceptions about psych wards.
Oh, yeah.
They think it's like either, you know, one flew over a cuckoo's nest, or it's straitjackets and people sounding like chickens. Basically, I volunteered and I went to akutmodtagelse in Danish, which means basically emergency reception, emergency psychiatric reception. Turned up one morning, that would have been a couple of months ago, and I just said, "These are the things that are happening." I talked to a doctor, a doctor who was specialized in that, as a psychiatrist, I suppose. And she said, since your main thing right now is social isolation, we'd like to just take you into a psych ward, an open psych ward, which meant I could have visitors and stuff. So I was in the emergency section for a night, and then I was moved to an open ward in Frederiksberg, which is not very far from the center of Copenhagen, and I was there for 3 weeks, was there to stabilize. Again, open ward, so I could have visitors, I could go for walks, I could, as long as I told them beforehand, you know, I could leave when I think there's a huge difference between open and closed wards. I've never been in a closed ward, but that's a very, very sort of different cup of tea. But I was in an open ward for 3 weeks, and then I was released, I suppose, a month and a half ago, more or less. I kind of date sometimes kind of slip. It's been an exercise in not being stubborn. Because I think there's another tendency that, like, our society gets very hyper individualistic, and you're supposed to solve your own problems, and you're, you know, so for me it's about just accepting help and just saying yes, yes. So actually, just saying yes and to intervention. That's sort of the short end of it, and now I'm in recovery.
That's great, you know. And normalizing the experience, the emergency psych ward is usually people who are actively psychotic and or suicidal ideation. So being in that open ward, we don't always have the distinction here at our hospitals in the States. We don't have really great mental health treatment here in the States. But the idea, there were some famous movies. One was called The Snake Pit in America, where, you know, just it's horrific. And then One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, kind of the ultimate in showing, you know, psychosurgery and decimating a person's whole personality. But let's talk, and I wondered while you were there, were they trying different kinds of medication? Because 3 weeks isn't a long time to check out various medications to give them a trial.
So when I arrived, I was on sertraline. I believe the brand name in the US is Zoloft, a very small dose. And then I was on my ADHD medication. And in the course of me being there, because they started suspecting type 2 bipolar disorder, they switched up my medication a little bit. So I phased out of sertraline and into a different one. It's called lamotrigine or something. I'm not sure what
Yes,
And it's basically, I believe it was like originally used for epilepsy, and then they figured out it also worked. It's like very similar to like the first, one of the first antidepressants, I believe Marplan was actually tuberculosis medicine, but then they figured that out. It had a side effect of making people feel better mentally. So, but anyway, lamotrigine is a mood stabilizer, and I'm currently in treatment with that, and at 150 milligrams right now. In the end, the idea is I go up to 200, and like I always say with medication, it's like it's an aid, it's a tool, it's not a solution, and like any tool, it. But the frustrating thing with medication, it takes a while sometimes to figure out if it is the tool you need. So right now I'm just in treatment with lamotrigine and seeing if that has the desired effect.
So you use the term bipolar two, and we've also talked before the interview about hypomania, and you can describe it so well. If you don't mind talking about hypomania and some examples of you being in a hypomanic state for the listeners who don't quite know what that is.
Right. So for the listeners who don't know what the diagnostic terminology, bipolar type one is what we used to call manic depressive, where people would go into severe mania, sometimes manic psychosis, and then also sometimes back into depression. And then type two can be tricky because it has often these periods of depression, feelings of worthlessness, low self-esteem, but then also hypomania. And I think extreme hypomania, to me, I describe with the caricature of someone on cocaine. You know, the someone who talks very fast and they have lots of ideas, and they just think everyone's it's going to be great, and everyone's I'm have so many ideas, I'm going to do all this and do this and this and this, and they start talking faster and start getting louder. They start like leaving other space for people. They're more prone to substance abuse, and spending money, being just generally irresponsible, and it can. It's a tricky one because if you come out of depression, often there's the rebound effect. I feel like of coming out of depression, where you feel, happier, you feel more motivated. But this is to, it's like taking that and then taking it up to 11, where you kind of push away everything that's negative, and you engage in too many projects, and you start sleeping less, and then eventually you burn out. And it can be tricky for the people around you to figure out what's going on, because you're never in psychosis. You're not seeing things that aren't there. You don't have delusions of things that aren't there. You're just too much, and you're too excited, and you're too much of everything. And I think the more people see it happening gradually from the outside, the more apparent it becomes. But if you don't have, I didn't have the language to describe it before. I knew the thing is, I knew that bipolar type two, and I knew other people that experience it, but I sort of brushed aside the possibility that that's what I was experiencing, and then putting it into words made it easier to quantify, I guess.
You have a wonderful way of describing it. And as I shared with you earlier, I also have hypomania, which can often get me in trouble. Some of the symptoms you mentioned, the overspending, the overexuberance, starting a lot of projects but never finishing one, and then getting overwhelmed because of what I haven't done and feeling regret. And did you ever use substances to help you with your symptoms?
For me, in the past, the main thing that I would default to was alcohol. I didn't smoke weed. I didn't do any like hard drugs or opiates. Alcohol was sort of the culprit. And it's also because this is a whole different topic, but Nordic society, especially, we have a very, very prominent alcohol culture where I think we have an alarming percentage of high functioning alcoholics in our society. And a society where drinking a lot isn't seen as a red flag in the way it should be. And so you can sort of get away with drinking a lot very often and more than you should without anyone really seeing it as a problem, because also to some extent that would make them reflect about their own alcohol use sometimes. So that was the main kind of like unhealthy self-medication mechanism I would use in periods.
Well, I'm a recovering alcoholic myself, and so I certainly used it to calm myself down, and I love removing myself totally from the world, and I did a lot of isolation, and I did a lot of things that I needed to make amends for later on. And I wanted to ask you, on a personal level, were there some relationships you had that you feel you caused irreparable damage to?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely have had people in the past, friendships and also romantic relationships, that where I feel like I burnt bridges or reached a point of no return where I'd done things or said things. It's 'cause that's the really, I think, the worst part with being this is my personal experience. I'm not sure if this is true for everyone, but when if you get overwhelmed with depression and you're not taking care of your symptoms and you're not accepting it and you're not facing it, you're more prone to projecting and lashing out, and you start accusing other people of things, or you start being very short with people, and especially if you're in denial about your symptoms, you become angry if people try to call things out, and you become very snappy and very unpleasant. And that is, I think, that you have to come to terms with that side of yourself. You have to acknowledge that that side is there, that there is that lingering, it's a kind of a cliche to call it darkness, but you know what I mean, when this lingering, I feel like that is, I feel like when you lash out, that is your inner critic and the worst voice inside of your self manifesting itself externally, where the things you tell yourself all the time when you're feeling low self-worth, suddenly you're telling to others as well, aiming at them as weapons. And that is when you really start burning bridges.
You use the term projection. So many psychological terms are part of our everyday vocabulary now. But projection, when I'm imposing my own feelings and beliefs onto somebody else, and I don't want to look at it, so then I do become angry and snappy and burn those bridges. So are you continuing in psychotherapy today, or what's going on now?
So now I'm attached to a clinic, a psychiatric clinic that is government run. Again, very we our system is sometimes overwhelmed as well in terms of like staff and stuff, but very luckily, living in Denmark, of course, we have free healthcare, free universal healthcare. So I've all of the help I've received in the last few months has been hasn't cost me anything, and I continue to have now I have weekly appointments at this clinic where they're just, following up on me, and now I'm then having these perennial talks with a special psychologist where they were examining the possibility of type 2 bipolar. And so and this is also a place I can call in case of emergency. And if I'm really, really feel really bad, I'm starting to isolate, they will literally come to my address as well, to check. They can have a session at my have the session at my place, or they can come to my place and, like, sort of knock on the door and I encourage them to do that if that should happen. It hasn't happened yet, but I encourage them to do that. And so they're just there to check up on me and also call me out on my bullshit, which
Yeah,
is
yes.
I told them from the beginning the thing that should be the thing they should be most wary of with me. I've learned that about myself is if I start to try to steer the conversation and try to sort of subtly manipulate them into talking about what I want to talk about and not talk about the problem, and that which is this very devious tactic that you tend to use when you don't want to talk about your problems. So I try to be as honest as possible, and then if I'm getting a little too eager, a little too excited, I encourage them to say, okay, easy there. Okay, breathe for a moment.
Yeah. Are you practicing any kind of meditation or mindfulness, which is one of the things I've used in my treatment for many, many years to help people? You just said sit down and breathe, but are you doing it for extended periods at all?
I haven't kept up the habit much, but I do it. I use definitely breathing exercises every day whenever I catch racing thoughts. I take a moment to breathe, and before sleep, I take a moment to breathe. So I think it's more micro practices than it is extended sessions, but I use that definitely mindfulness as like micro practice.
Now, have you been still playing D&D?
Also haven't done that for a little over a year, except with a couple of exceptions. And that's something, as I sort of recover, it's something I want to do again. I During COVID, during lockdown, we had a online D&D group, me and some other improvisers, and later on we had a different online D&D group. But I haven't done it for a little haven't done much of it for a little over a year. It's definitely something I want to get back into eventually.
And what about improv?
Again, I haven't done that in a little over a year, and again, it was I was sort of pushing that aside. I was also doing other things, and I was not making space for it. I also started to feel guilty about my behavior, and so I also actively stopped coming to certain places and things because I felt ashamed. So and then the other part of then depression, apart from the self-blame and shame and guilt, the other part of depression, at least one of the symptoms I'm experiencing that some people experience, is the lack of joy in activities that would otherwise give joy, and the evasion of those activities. So I'm also part of what I'm doing right now is rekindling joy, because I found it very difficult to do joyful activities, which right now means mostly video games. That's that's something I'm that's one of my stepping stones to rekindling joy, because that's something I was doing a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah, and finding that joy is so important, and being with other people. As I mentioned, sometimes I tended to socially isolate, and I find that pushing myself sometimes to be with other people, even just for a coffee or a lunch, something like that, gets me out of my head, because being in my head is a very dangerous place to be. And being able to give support and love to others, you know, the Beatles said, and in the end, the love we make is equal to the love we take. And I think it's all about loving ourselves, forgiving ourselves, and getting on and being part. And you're such a beautifully expressive, articulate man, and you're still really young. So what do you see ahead of you in the opening the windows and the doors to the sunshine? What do you see for yourself, Charles?
I feel like both the best and the worst things in my life have come from not planning ahead. But I think it's about, and I don't usually plan too far ahead. I think I'm more of a process-oriented than product-oriented person. So for me, it's about, and I'm returning to the word micro-practice, but sort of taking things day by day, probably starting to go to see other people's improv shows, you know, reintegrating into it. Also rekindling the idea that it's okay to start projects, because the thing is, when you have fallen into the trap of starting too many projects, you can also fall away the other way and then be afraid of starting any projects at all. So it's telling myself it's okay to start things again, it's okay to participate in things again, and try to be aware if I am doing anything more than is sustainable. But it's like you alluded to, you sort of have to also put in energy to gain energy in a way. That's why isolation is never helpful. At least not if you're having that particular issue. Isolation over long periods of time is not helpful. So just like little practices of getting back into those areas, and they're not so scary as my brain will make them out to be.
Certainly, living a day at a time, staying in 24-hour compartments, and sometimes just a moment at a time, is certainly the best prescription, I think, for many of us. I want to thank you for your honesty and generosity in sharing your story with me today. It's incredibly touching, and I'm so glad we had this time together. And I think that you're on a marvelous journey.
Sorry, I interrupt you. I just wanted to say thank you so much for your words, and also for taking time to talk, and for listening and being who you are as well.
Thank you. And I think your words are going to help a lot of people that may have similar feelings, thoughts, and have been afraid. And I'm seeing this as a opening for other people as well. So I'm so glad we met. Maybe someday it will be in person. One never knows. But I wish you the best of success in your recovery and your life.
Thank you so much. And wish you all the best as well. I definitely hope. Maybe one day at the time of a blue moon, we might encounter each other in person. The improv world, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
That's true. So farewell for now, and have a wonderful rest of your day. A great evening over there.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and look forward to you joining us next time on Improv Interviews with Margot Escott.